You're listening to the Berkman Audio Fishbowl from the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University. Each week, we feature conversations with leading cyber scholars, entrepreneurs, activists, and policymakers as they explore the bleeding edge of the internet and technology, democracy, law, and society. For more information on the Berkman Center and for more programs like this, visit cyber.law.harvard.edu.
Our guest speaker today is Andy Oram. I've been reading Andy for a great many years. He's been a reliable author of articles and books for O'Reilly, and is quite an authority on internet freedom, on free software, on policy, on the intersection of all these things, and has been writing more recently, and I think with a great deal of authority, about the cloud, a term that we all through a great deal. I might say, well, a lot of people are talking about the cloud, Andy really knows the weather. So with that as an introduction, I'll pass it over to Andy.
Yes. You know, one of the advantages touted for cloud computing, you know, is green energy. They're going to reduce the use of energy, and maybe we can do something about the climate change that produced 5 storms in the past month. I appreciate that you came here for this. Cloud computing, okay? Cloud computing, free software, not free in terms of beer, but free as in freedom. So these are both great, great developments in humanity. They're going to really make things better for a lot of people. And there have been people who have been trying to put together the idea of freedom, to bring the idea of freedom from free software into the cloud. But I don't think they've quite got it. I don't think they've quite gone deep enough. So I recently thought of a new way of approaching this, which is really going into the architecture, how the software is developed. I think this might get us closer to what we want. So let's take a look at the cloud. It's a very vague term. It's often criticized because it's so vague. It has a lot of different, it's broken down to different categories that look like Dutch prepositions. But when I was doing an article, the American Reporter, there's an online publication called The American Reporter. It's non-technical. And the editor asked me to do a simple one-sentence definition of the cloud. And at first I said no. But he really pushed me. So I tried one, and I think this might actually be a nice one. I thought maybe it would appeal to lawyers, the stuff about the contractual stuff. It's that someone else is owning the computer you're running on, and there's a contractual arrangement. This doesn't mean you're paying for it. You know, you're using Gmail or Twitter, you don't have to pay them to have a contractual arrangement with them. And if you don't know that you have a contractual arrangement, well, you haven't been reading your terms of service. So this is we can use this as a starting point. It is very vague. I could tell you how big it's going to be and how, I could give you anecdotes, I could give you figures, but it would be much better just to quote Gartner. What does Gartner say here? By 2012, 20% of businesses will own no IT assets, because they're using the cloud. So that's been disputed in this article. Then there's Saugatuck, another major analyst. One of the things, and let's see if I can remember one of the things that's not in this article. Saugatuck said that by 2015, 65% of all new software developments will be in the cloud or hybrid. Okay, so it's going to be big. The analysts love the cloud. Business leaders love it. The technologists talk a lot about it. But at the same time, there's a lot of worries about it. The same people who are saying this is going to be so big and it's going to dominate our lives, they're also saying there's big problems with the cloud. And I don't want to go over all this in detail. I want to keep the talk down to 15 or 20 minutes. You can find millions of things on the web. If you go onto any forum that talks about the cloud or sites that have blogs and stuff, they will tell you about this stuff. Like, the provider can go out of business. Doc himself wrote a blog last week about worries that a major service would go out of business, and if somebody had uploaded thousands and thousands of photos, you'd lose it all. Or at least if you might have it on your computer, but you can no longer share it with people because you'd spend all those hours uploading and it was gone. Or they could kick you off for dubious reasons. Somebody thought you were doing something obnoxious. There are also security issues. For instance, if something like TJ Maxx can be hit and lose millions of or thousands of people's social security numbers, what about a cloud service which will aggregate the data from hundreds of companies? On all these things, as well as availability and security, each one of these items has a liability part to it. So If I have my service running in the cloud and they go down, I owe something to my customers, even though it wasn't my fault. So these come up now for the past year or year and a half. These have been in the press, on the blogs. These have been talked about a lot. There are other issues in the cloud, but I'm not going to go into those. For instance, when you run something in the cloud, the data that used to be right next to your computer is now out there, and there's a lot more bandwidth usage. That's a technical issue. You have to train people. There's organizational issues. But I'm not going to talk about those. I'm going to stick to policy, because the architectural solution that I am going to present later, that really addresses the policy issues, not the other issues. Long before the business analysts and the technologists and the lawyers were complaining about these aspects of the cloud, there was another group that had caught on to it early, and that's the free software community. And they were saying, for instance, cloud computing is stupidity. So the first reaction of the free software community is just say no. Don't do it. Don't use the cloud. And they soon realized that was like trying to hold back the ocean. So the next approach was to try to find, why do these slides generate laughter? Something's going on. I will tell you, I have tried to find some representatives of the free software community whose pictures don't make them look like they're in the running to become ancient Hebrew prophets. So I have not been able to do that. And all these guys are Jewish too, you know. So this may tell you, if there's this relationship between Jewishness and free software advocacy, this can tell you about the relationship between free software and righteousness, maybe. But we have to talk here about practicality. So there are very cogent arguments here about the cloud. But when the business analysts and the lawyers and stuff read this, they may say, oh, these guys are idealists and they're not really dealing with the issues I care about. You have to really look at what free software is and what free software offers to realize that what these people are talking about, even though it sounds very idealistic and abstract, it is the same thing that I was talking about before. It's the freedom to change things and to share and to use your own systems and not be beholden to anybody else. So there are some people who are trying to find some ways to bring freedom into the cloud. I'm going to just go over a few things on one slide, because you can also find a lot online about this. I'm not going to spend a lot of time describing other people's solutions. You have the Afero license. This is trying to bring the reciprocality of the GNU license, GPL, into the cloud. So if a cloud provider uses somebody's software and makes a change to it, under this license, they have to release the change so other people can use it. Well, that's a nice advance, and it means that other people can use other people can build on what you've done, which is nice, but that doesn't change the basic power relationship. If someone owns the cloud system or the software as a service system, they have your data, there's network effects because other people are there. That's a power relationship where they're in charge. So the next stage, people talk about open data. Google's ruling a lot on this. And I do believe that any cloud provider, any software as a service provider should allow you to take out your data in some standard format, some human readable format like say XML or JSON. So that is a basic thing that they should do, but that doesn't really change the relationship once again because they still have it. By the time you need to get your data out, you're already in big trouble. If you need your data, that means they've gone down and you're looking around for another service to do the same thing. Another proposal is standards. This is usually at the lower level, infrastructure as a service, standards for how to provide entire systems to people so that you can easily move things around. It makes it nice for a programmer to create a script that can run on many different services. So that does increase competition. It makes things a little more reliable. Something like Google's Open Social means that you could submit the same data to many different social networks at once. So that reduces some of the lock-in of Facebook, so forth. But that, I don't think, still goes as far as it could to make the cloud truly free. And then we have the P2P solution. And this is quite interesting. The big example that people talk about now is Diaspora. And Diaspora is supposed to be sort of a Facebook. It actually has been funded partly by Facebook. It's supposed to be a P2P Facebook. They're trying to do what Jabber tried to do back in 2000. The idea being that you could run your own server and put out messages and people could share messages on different servers. I think this is kind of interesting. I'm not sure that they've really worked out all the trust issues and the issues of connectivity and discovery and so forth that a P2P network needs. P2P networks are very difficult. Furthermore, we have to remember that we sometimes want things aggregated. For instance, we don't just want messages from our friends. We may want to look online and see what people are saying about Berkman right now. We may want to do sentiment analysis, find out whether they love my talk or hate it right now. So I think inevitably there will be centralized services that slurp up what we're giving them and feed it back to us. I have another solution, which I think comes closer than anything suggested so far to bringing freedom into the cloud. And the problem being that the cloud is a black box right now. All you can do is submit your data or submit your application to it and have it run there. And I want to open up the box. So this is the central part of my talk. This is where you have to pay attention because it gets a little complicated. I'm going to go through the whole architecture on one slide and we'll see what we come out with. We start with a computer on the bottom, and on top of it is running software, but I suggest we divide it into software that's application related and then sort of basic software that doesn't change very often. Your operating system, your DNS, firewalling, maybe spam and antivirus filtering. This stuff could be in what programmers sometimes call a harness, although I've used a saddle here because I think a saddle is a better metaphor for it. So these things that don't change very often and aren't that interesting will be on one set of software, and then the application can be running on top of it. The application is what's unique, what people are really interested in. It's fast changing. It's where most of your value lies. For these things to work together, the application and the saddle, whatever. Oh, I accidentally put out the next slide. The application can be, if it's free software, it can be cloned. So a customer can do another version that puts in a feature that he or she wants. A third-party vendor could put in a new feature. Even a competitor could put in a new feature. All these things could be added to the software. You could have old versions of software, because sometimes a vendor will take out something that you want to use, or they might just add so many features that it gets bloated and runs more slowly, so you may want an old version. All these things could be kept, and you could be running any version you choose. There would probably be one default version to keep things simple, because most people would just want to go to the site, run whatever is there. But all these other versions should be available. What I wanted to say about the relationship between the application and the saddle is that it's best for them to be free software so that the interface is very clean and very well exposed. You can have standards, you can have proprietary software, certainly that has two different parts communicating, but they tend to get out of sync, they tend to develop cruft and odd features and stuff and get bloated. So we have found that free software tends to make it easier for parts to communicate and for people to build on. And free software would allow both the saddle and the application to be changed by other people. So if we have free software for these things, you could have other providers, and this would provide the competition and the fallback that people want. And they could be running their own versions of the software or running the same version of the software. We still haven't addressed, though, the data. We could still have data lock-in. So I'm suggesting that the user would keep the data separate. There would be a repository just for data, probably multiple repositories, because you want to have a backup. So the data is not stored with the provider. When you want to run an application, you choose your application, you choose your data, you submit the data to the application, it runs. Once again, like with the saddle and the application, we have to have a clean interface, maybe human readable like XML or JSON, between the data and the application. Your data would be in a standard format. You could submit it to one application on one day and a different version of the application on another day, store it back, probably with a checksum to check in case there's corruption later, something that I discussed in an article. This is basically the architecture. The data is separate. The data is safe. You can choose different vendors at your whim. Different vendors can compete. If one goes down, others are there. It's an architectural solution, I believe, to a lot of the problems that have been cited about the cloud. So I created a discussion document. I very appropriately used the cloud for the discussion document. You can ask me if you want to contribute to it. What I did was take the list of items before, the list of problems with the cloud, And I put that up as a series of columns, a series of rows. Each one is a row. And then across the top, we have the problem, the likelihood of it happening, and the risk of the harm when it does happen. If you do any security work, you know that this is how security experts tend to break things down. How likely is something to happen, and then how bad is it if it does happen? And then how can my solution help? Or perhaps it can't help. It would be nice to see what things are actually improved and what things would not be improved by this solution. So this document will be available to anybody who asks for it. I think the last point I should make before we start discussion is to ask why vendors would do this. They've got this proprietary software. They spent money on it. Why should they open it? And I think there are reasons to do it. I think there are good incentives to do it. First of all, almost anyone who does cloud computing or software as a service uses free software. Things like JavaScript, Ruby on Rails, PHP, they know free software, they know the community, they're used to working with the community. They're not like a lot of bureaucrats you've seen in large organizations, maybe in government or business, who don't know what free software means. They do know what it means. And they understand some of the benefits too. For instance, when you put out your software under free license, like the MySQL company did, now part of Oracle, a lot of people get to know your software, and those are your future hires. These are the experts who can make your software better in the next round. So there are reasons to make it free. Furthermore, all the advantages of keeping it proprietary are, I think, pretty slim. Most software can be reproduced. People can recode what they see. And I think the things that really make services popular are things like staying up. You know, most of the social networks I use go down sometimes. If you stay up, if you provide good service, if you have an attractive look, which you can trademark. If you provide other things around the software itself, the code, is not really the competitive advantage you have. And you'll have your first mover advantage and your network effects and so forth. And finally, the real reason for doing this is that you solve some of the problems that I had said at the beginning of the talk. People will trust you more. They will feel better about using the software because they know they can go somewhere else if necessary. They know that they won't lose everything if you go down, and that should make your service more appealing to them. So I am ready to open it up. I want to hear what people think about this. Okay, maybe you should
start with a quick one. Just okay. Somebody said, doesn't it start to sound either like grid computing or SOAs? So mm-hmm. You have a response to that?
Well, I see grid computing. So I could see the comparison with grid computing, because in grid computing you have many systems cooperating that are owned by different people. Well, I think that's similar to a P2P solution. So, but I don't think I have seen anybody suggest the particular. Perhaps someone is suggesting that the grid computing divides things into two parts. You have the substrate and the application. Well, there might be something there. I don't want to say too much more about it. Yeah. I think you should. Can you take the question so I could just concentrate? Well, okay, I'll take the question. Ron.
Okay. Well, going back to your diagram, let's take a popular application which I think could be considered some sort of cloud application, which is meetup.com. Mm-hmm. How would you decompose it into the pieces you're talking about so that it would fit into this framework? I'm bringing that up especially because it has suffered very recently from one of the big problems you just mentioned, which is that they yanked features out that everybody was depending on. And
I don't know if there's anything special. Of course, I have used Meetup. I suppose what's special about that site is that you're not just using it for your own. It's not like Salesforce.com. I think maybe you used a good example here, because Meetup.com use it precisely because other people are using it.
Right, so I'm not sure how you decompose it and still make it replicable and still have it work. Mm-hmm.
It would have to do with data storage. As long as you are really entrusting your data to a centralized service, then that's sort of a choke point. That's true. But we could have data stored in different locations. It's
sounds like that was a hard example to use. Right?
Yes, well, it's a good example because it's a hard example. I think it is key that just highlights the importance of keeping the data separate. And we talk a lot in, you know, free software and cloud computing stuff about people owning their own data and what does that mean? Like, do you really, what is your data? You know, you can see I'm wearing a blue shirt. Does that mean it's my data that I'm wearing a blue shirt? You know, so.
Right, if I'm attending somebody else's meeting, is it my data or is it the organizer's data? It seems like it's both of ours. And if you take either of us away from it, it isn't useful.
So if you want redundancy and resiliency, then you probably have to have backups that are not restricted to a single organization. And that's an interesting thing that we should look further at. I hadn't thought too much about that. But I do know that there is a big debate about whose data. And European privacy laws are often criticized because they restrict journalists and so forth. Some people say that data should not always be under the control of an individual, so forth. Thanks. And someone else had a question over here. Okay.
Joseph, my name is Joseph. You mentioned that Facebook funded Diaspora, and I was intrigued about that and wondered if you could say more, because while you enumerate a number of reasons as to why these companies would like we adopt a more open architecture instead of interchange formats, I'm still skeptical. Mm-hmm. So I'm curious if you know of any cases of a market leader actually doing this sort of thing. Perhaps the Diaspora example is one of them.
Well, I don't know why Facebook did it. I'll let you answer in a minute. You seem to have. But I do know that there are a few sites that have free software and have all they have released their software as free. StatusNet is one of them. They do the Identica site. And WordPress and Drupal have done it. And there are a couple of others. I wrote an article. At the end, there's a pointer to an article using a great cloud service, Bitly. And so there's more in the article. What would you like to talk about Diaspora?
To quote an article about Diaspora's funding, which had a quote from Mark Zuckerberg in it, I saw a bit of myself in them. Or it was that, or it was they reminded me of myself. He gave them money because he thought that they were kids who were doing something he thought was like similar to what he'd done.
It wasn't institutional.
There was?
It was Mark Zuckerberg's funding.
Okay. Well, that's important that it was Zuckerberg and not Facebook. I think there is a sense among people. I think my own boss, Tim O'Reilly, is like this. He gets a sense if there's something big happening, you should get in on it, even if it seems to threaten your current business model. If it's going to be big, you better get in on it because, yeah, especially if it does. Someone else had a hand up back here. Okay. Aaron.
I enjoyed that a lot. I was curious because I think you're better informed about this than I am. It occurred to me as you were saying this that there already are services that sort of provide anonymous data storage online, and they're kind of like, BitLockers or sites that are often used to anonymously upload and download files. It's often alternatives to peer-to-peer networks, things like that. Do you see that as a potential, maybe, at the moment they're often criminalized or sort of delegitimized for the fact that a lot of the traffic seems to be either, you know, unauthorized file sharing and things like that.
Or pornography or something.
Or pornography or something else that keeps people up at night. But, does that seem like a potentially legitimate line of business for folks like that? Is this a way to get them back on the radar and back in the good graces of the internet regulators?
Yeah. Well, certainly data as a service. It's a form of data as a service, right? It's not that much different from S3, you're uploading your stuff there. So those services, I think those are going to be a key part of the solution. You can put your data and replicate your data.
Well then, so what do you see as the key difference between your solution and, I mean, is the key difference between your solution and the ecosystem that exists now that we just need to tie all these existing parts together in a structured way? Is it that we need standards to make the communication more open?
I think we need those and we need more. The way that cloud computing is done now, it's, I think everything is just kind of jammed together. I don't think that at this point a Facebook or Twitter could take apart things and provide, they do have APIs to what they're doing, but I don't think they could really make it free software. It would take a lot of work. It's really a change to how you do your coding, and working with a community is very different from just working in a small group together using, say, agile methods. Mm-hmm. And there's more in the article about that. So I do think it'll take a lot of changes in how the software as a service vendors and the infrastructure as a service vendors do their work. But all those other things are important too. The data services are important. Perhaps some peer-to-peer stuff could be incorporated. Okay. All right.
So I like the idea, and I had a lot of the same questions that these two fellows had. And I was really wondering, when you brought up the reasons why service providers might want to adopt such a system, it seemed like the arguments were largely why they would want to adopt open source as opposed to why they might want to adopt such this kind of data repository system. Mm-hmm. It seems to me another question, or perhaps an answer to that question, was what this fellow here said, which is essentially that there are certain services that these companies provide that essentially can't be replicated within this data repository. And so the fact that Meetup provides an opportunity for people to meet up and coordinate and so forth will itself solve perhaps what we might see as a conflict of interest between companies that would want to get involved versus companies that that might want to retain their market advantage.
So something like Meetup has a kind of choke point, a natural choke point, and they might as well open up a lot of stuff because they still have an advantage. People still choose to go there. The key is, the question is, can you have a choke point that makes your business viable and makes it useful, but at the same time not be such a choke point that you could really screw people? You could go down or something.
Yes. What Meetup did in the last month or so was they changed their data model. They took out a whole category of response types called maybes. How I'm trying to figure out how somebody would build something that interfaces with Meetup and yet provides this functionality that they just yanked out and still interoperates.
Hmm. Yeah.
I don't know if people here are familiar with that, but that,
Well, let me speculate. You are putting me on the spot here. So I'm just going to totally randomly fantasize, which is the way I came up with this thing in the first place, of course, creativity, initiative, all the great American virtues, right? Well, let's say that they took out the maybes, and a group of people didn't like that. So if it was free software, they would go back and get an old version. And then they would create some kind of interface so that when you submit your request, or you RSVP, it would go simultaneously to Meetup and to Meetup Prime. Yeah. So it would go both to the new service that lacked the feature, and it would go to the reconstituted service that still had the feature. You could be in both places. And if people want maybes, they would use it, and if not, they wouldn't. Does that perhaps get where you're going?
Sort of, but doesn't really work, because it means now you've got different people with different views of the same data, and they're semantically conflicting.
It makes it does make it more complicated. Now, you have two different things. It could make things more complicated, but basically one would be a superset of the other. Everything that was in the regular Meetup would be in the Meetup Prime. In addition, you would have an extra category called Maybe. So it could possibly work, but it's good for future thinking and maybe some experimentation. I guess I should let you go.
Thank you. I like how your architecture puts market competition and innovation in the service of people. Mm-hmm. Brings back some kind of openness to competition for users. I was wondering if you could comment on or speculate about the perception of personal computation that would be needed in order to stimulate your type of architecture that asks an individual to actively or passively be involved in a process of re-repositing their own data in something that they feel some degree of ownership over, rather than just passing off their entrails into the cloud.
So are you asking about people having to learn more about what their data is and taking care of it properly, that they don't just go to Google Docs and throw stuff there and it's going to be fine? Are you asking about people taking more responsibility for it, learning more about it?
I think that's certainly a dimension of what I'm asking. I think I might also maybe put it in the shades of just the very vague debate about closed and open systems in which people are computing and the various benefits of them and ease with which computation can happen in systems that provide everything for you versus those that require you to put some degree of effort in.
I think I can see a relationship of what you're saying to some of the problems that come up with free software, because sometimes at a conference I'll hear somebody talk about the benefits of having free software, say in schools and universities, and yet when they describe it, it's obvious that somebody has to understand it very well, that you're not having your hand held as much. I think that is that sort of what you're talking about, perhaps. I think one of the great things about the cloud is it makes things simpler for people. I think that's one of the advantages. But if you care about things like having your data in a redundant place, then that should be possible too. So it's a good place to start with, and we should also make it possible. As I said in one of the slides where there were multiple horses, there should be one default that's really simple, and people can just use that if they want to just get their job done, not think about it. But the other horses should be there so that people can have alternatives. And then maybe as people get more sophisticated, we'll have more variety. Okay.
Andy, so I've been writing a lot lately about a problem that we refer to as intermediary censorship. And probably the simplest way to think about this would be to think about what happened when WikiLeaks tried to move on to Amazon's cloud platform and Amazon decided that they didn't want them as a customer and left them high and dry. It strikes me that the problem that I've at least been trying to solve in thinking through cloud alternatives is that if you want protection from certain attacks, particularly denial of service, you really need a pretty robust computing environment with sysadmins who are protecting from attack, and that probably requires quite a few resources and quite a big player. At the same time, if that player then decides that they don't want to play with you, you end up screwed in much the same way that WikiLeaks was screwed. I'm basically seeing two choke points developing instead of one within your architecture, which is now I can get through it screwed by my application provider or my data provider. I can move somewhere else, but the somewhere else may not actually be able to help me, because the whole point of being able to shelter on a big server is to have someone who's actually protecting me against this sort of attack. So I guess I'm wondering whether this helps solve any of my problems.
Is the microphone placement good enough to capture everybody who's talking?
No.
Yeah, I don't know.
I think close enough.
I am trying to repeat a few words of what people say so that the webcast can capture this. And what Ethan is pointing out is that sometimes you need a big service. WikiLeaks needed an enormous service like Amazon to protect it from things like denial of service attacks. So therefore, they became, because there's only one Amazon, they became captive to Amazon when it decided to kick them off. I think there are always trade-offs like this. Let's look back at, say, the State of the Union address and lauding small businesses. We're all in love with small business. This is the engine of the economy. But there are certain things that are best produced by large businesses, like Campbell's soup. Maybe that's not a good example, because you could probably get healthier things. You know, oil. There are certain things that benefit by having large businesses. And if we got rid of large businesses, we couldn't do them. And I think that's the same trade-off in this cloud computing. So there are times when you need a big service. WikiLeaks cannot depend on a few people in a back room. Yeah. Well, that's an unfortunate trade-off. But probably there will be more competition as it gets bigger and bigger. So there may be something else like Amazon that becomes big enough, and it could be in other countries. It could be in Dubai, perhaps. It could be in places where it's harder for pressure and for the law to reach. Does that help? But it is a dilemma. I agree with that. Okay.
This is related to that, but one of the things that you noted as a privacy concern was that a problem with cloud computing is that governments can approach the cloud and not have to go through individuals in terms of getting information about individuals. And that question made me think that if you split the application from the data, you end up with multiple gateways instead of just one gateway, which means more people than governments can ask. So I don't know, you know, again, what the technical aspect of the data repositories would be. But it seems to me if you have more people that governments ask, there's a larger likelihood that you get a yes answer than if you have a single company.
So it does seem like my architecture would have data spread out in more places. There'd be a lot of data services, and you're saying it would be in more places, but that also means that if the government knew where you put your data, And particularly if you have it in two or three places, so it's in, you're storing it there for redundancy's sake, for safekeeping, that means two or three places where they can go and try to get it.
Yeah.
Probably you need encryption too. And quantum computing may someday render encryption useless against large attackers, but then we'll all be in big trouble because our society is really depending more and more on secure data. So I think you do have a valid point there. On one hand, decentralizing the location of data is good because it means there's less of a single target, like the TJ Maxx example I provided. On the other hand, if you put it in more places, there are more people responsible for it. So you have a point there, and I think perhaps encryption could be the solution to that, at least currently. Okay. Yes.
So I think that one of the reasons why cloud computing is attractive to a lot of businesses is that, you know, it seems to them that they can just outsource all of their IT stuff. You know, Gartner said, you know, businesses won't have any IT assets, and that also includes people who know about IT. Mm-hmm. And so I think one of the challenges with your proposed architecture is that it also requires, again, people to have some kind of understanding of, you know, what's going on with their data and how things work, and having some idea of, you know, that they can move between providers. So I think if people, you know, see cloud computing as a way to sort of have their computing be something they don't need to worry about, then this sort of goes back towards, you know, the end of the spectrum where you have P2P. It's sort of, I think it's useful to see your solution as some lying somewhere on the spectrum between, you know, completely centralized things and the sort of extreme peer-to-peer, you know, all of the data and all of the software is completely decentralized.
Yeah, there are a lot of interesting points in there. One simply being that I'm making something complicated when people want it to be simple. They just go to Gmail, they don't worry about whether they're using HTTPS or not. So, another idea being that this is sort of a peer-to-peer solution, it's or a hybrid, or sort of halfway between pure centralized model and a pure peer-to-peer model, which could be true. As for requiring IT knowledge and making it more complicated, I think for most institutions, you still need IT, which is good news, say for my company, which puts out books for IT people. Certainly, with infrastructure as a service and platform as a service, there's still a lot of things that need to be done. You may not be plugging and unplugging wires, but you're doing a lot of things with performance. You're worrying about backup. I think one of the studies, what was the site? There was one major study suggesting that IT costs would still be about 90% of what they were when you had everything on your own servers after you put things in the cloud. So I think you do save some money and some people from IT, but there's still that with IaaS, PaaS. Now with SaaS, I still think you need people in a company. Certainly a company would need people who understand data and understand making sure it's clean, and there's still some expertise that you would need. So my system might introduce some new complexity, but I still think there are people, and we go back to what someone here was pointing out, that an individual who's using Gmail right now would need to be more educated to use my system. And I would like to make it possible to keep it simple for people, but also make it possible for them to become more sophisticated when they're ready to become more sophisticated.
This isn't a question from the back channel, but three names that I'll throw at you, and if you want to remark on them, feel free. Globus, Eucalyptus, and the Zen Cloud Platform. Are those steps in the directions you're talking about?
Those are part, well, I think they might fall under the solution of, they're similar. They might fall under the solution of open standards, where the idea being that the cloud, I think that they don't change the architecture of the cloud. They simply mean that there are standards and there's free software that you can use to create the cloud. So this may have ripple effects. It may improve certain things. It may make it easier to have competition in the cloud. But I'd say I covered that pretty much under the open standards bullet item. Right. More? We have.
If there isn't another one, what I've talked to what Joseph was calling market leaders about the aspirations that you're talking about here. In the VRM world, we have some of the same aspirations. The answer I often get is, we have APIs. Mm-hmm. APIs cover this. APIs are the great open hooks between things. Flickr is a very good example, and Twitter is another. Like, we have such an open API. It doesn't matter that we have a closed box, but you can get stuff in and out of here very easily. You know, with Flickr, for example, you can, if you bother, suck everything that's in there out and put it somewhere else. I don't know what I'd do with it, honestly, and outside
that's
their format. And
that's
why
I said, if you have open data, by the time you need it, you're in trouble. Because you also need alternative services.
So how do you argue against that when you hear that argument? Of the APIs cover a lot of what you're dealing with, and they're easy for companies to do. And is it just a patch? Is it just a step in the right direction and not a, because it's a half step and not a whole step, insufficient?
Yeah, that, I don't think it changes the power relationship that much. It doesn't. It still means that your data is there. Someone could start a competing service, but and also the issue Ron brought up: if you have two services trying to share data, they could easily get out of sync. I think if you had if you really designed a system so that there could be multiple versions of the software, and that people could choose whatever version they want from day to day, you would have a lot more independence. People could keep their data where they want, and systems would evolve in a freer fashion. And I was thinking of something else. Oh, it slipped to my mind. Not important. Okay.
I'm going to push back on that. It's sort of like, well, what does it mean for it to be my data if what the data consists of is, you know, what events I'm attending and who my friends are and what messages I've exchanged with them? That's not just my data. It's a whole bunch of other people's data.
Yes. And that's true of most social networks. Yes. They do mingle things together. Well, that would be a problem. I actually recognize that the problem when I mentioned in a bold item about P2P. I said that we want people to aggregate our data sometimes. And I recognize that as a problem with the P2P solution, and as one of our audience pointed out, it would apply to this sort of halfway solution too. So we have a balance here.
It's also a place where you really can't have multiple definitions of the data format or get very confused.
If there are multiple definitions, it could get confused. Well, we went over this, you know, and I was suggesting, I think we have to think more about it, but I was suggesting that there could be supersets of data. There could be places where data was stored that were not totally controlled by one company. It's something that should be experimented with. There are also other systems that are more like Salesforce.com where people are not mingling data. Those are more traditional, what they used to call application service providers before we had software as a service. We could start with those, and then we could look at the harder cases. But I think there might be solutions
not
for the harder cases.
I don't know anything about it. But
okay. Yes.
So, Andy, are you optimistic that this transition is going to happen naturally, or is there a role for law to play in perhaps requiring standard setting or disclosure, transparency, some limitations on discrimination on due to content, that kind of thing?
Well, what usually happens, I think this is very similar to other places in technology, and especially computer technology, where the best government role is not trying to set a standard, but setting a good model. So governments can adopt systems like this. They can try to make sure that they're doing the best thing. And governments have certain responsibilities. I'm sort of sliding over into talks I've given about free software and governments. Governments have certain responsibilities to the public. And if they look at these things, if they can find an architectural solution that means that they're more open, that they're more resilient, then there'll be a market that it could be a starting point for deploying these things. But regulation, that usually doesn't help very much. I think that to make this happen, it is a big change. I think some companies are going to have to be seized with the urge to try it. And I mentioned there are a few companies that are using the Affero license and are opening up their software. There'll have to be more companies that want to try this architectural solution, which is somewhat complicated, and work with the community, which is somewhat complicated. And then there might be some standard setting. I also have a little bit of, I'm a little cynical about standard setting because it takes so long. And everything in the modern computer era moves fast. And if you set standards, then you usually find that the members of the community setting the standards have run ahead of you, and you're always trying to catch up. And that's another reason to use free software, because then you don't have to worry about a standard. You use what you like, you change it if you don't like it,
and people find ways to work together.
Thank you.